Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, January 5th, 2024. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Today's weather in the Cedar Rapids area will be mostly cloudy, with winds from the southeast at 5 to 15 miles per hour and a high of 35. Tonight's overnight low is expected to be 25. On the front page of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette, the lead article is an Associated Press article titled School Tragedy. A 17-year-old opened fire at a central Iowa school on the first day of school after the winter break, killing a sixth grader and wounding five others Thursday as students barricaded in offices, ducked into classrooms, and fled in panic. The suspect, a student at the school in Perry, died of what investigators believe is a self-inflicted gunshot wound, an Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation official said. Authorities said one of the five people wounded was an administrator and later identified as Perry High School principal Dan Marburger by an Eastern Iowa school district where he graduated from high school. Authorities identified the shooter as Dylan Butler, aged 17, and provided no information about a possible motive. Two friends and their mother, who spoke with the Associated Press, said Butler was a quiet person who had been bullied for years. Perry has almost 8,000 residents and is about 40 miles northwest of Des Moines. It is home to a large pork processing plant and low-slung, single-story homes spread among trees now shorn of their leaves by winter. The high school and middle school are connected, sitting on the east edge of town. Authorities said the shooter had a pump-action shotgun and a small-caliber handgun. Mitch Mortvedt, the State Investigation Division's assistant director, said during a news conference that authorities also found a, quote, pretty rudimentary, end quote, improvised explosive device and rendered it safe. The suspect's motive is being investigated and authorities are looking into, quote, a number of social media posts, end quote, he made around the time of the shooting. Mortvedt added, all of the shootings occurred inside the high school, but he said students from other grades may have been there for a breakfast program. Sisters Yesenia Roeder and Kamya Hall, both 17, said alongside their mother, Alita, that Butler was bullied relentlessly since elementary school, but it escalated recently when his younger sister started getting picked on too. Officials at the school didn't intervene, they said, and that was, quote, the last straw, end quote, for Butler. Quote, he was hurting. He got tired. He got tired of the bullying. He got tired of the harassment, Yesenia Roeder Hall, age 17, said. Was it a smart idea to shoot up the school? No, God, no. End quote. Perry High School senior Ava Augustus said she was awaiting a counselor in a school office when she heard three shots. Unable to flee through a small window, she and others barricaded the door and were ready to throw things if necessary. Quote, and then we hear, he's down, you can go out, Augustus said through tears. And I run, and you can just see glass everywhere, blood on the floor. I get to my car, and they're taking a girl out of the auditorium who had been shot in her leg, end quote. Three gunshot victims were taken by ambulance to Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines, a spokesperson said. Some other patients were transported to a second hospital in Des Moines, a spokesperson for Mercy One Des Moines Medical Center confirmed, declining to comment on the number of patients or their statuses. Mortvedt said one person was in critical condition, but the injuries did not appear to be life-threatening. The other victims were stable, he said. Candlelight Vigil. Hundreds of community members gathered for a candlelight prayer vigil Thursday evening at a park where hours earlier students had been dropped off to reunite with their families after the shooting. Bundled up against freezing temperatures, they listened to pastors from many faiths and heard a message of hope in both English and Spanish. A post on the high school's Facebook page said it would be closed today and counseling services would be available for students, faculty, and others in the community. Governor Kim Reynolds ordered all flags in Iowa lowered to half staff. Quote, this senseless tragedy has shaken our entire state to its core, she said. In Washington, President Joe Biden and U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland were briefed on the shooting. FBI agents from the Omaha-Des Moines office are assisting with the investigation led by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Political background. The shooting occurred in the backdrop of Iowa's looming first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses. GOP candidate Vivek Ramaswamy had a campaign event scheduled in Perry at 9 a.m., about 1.5 miles from the high school, but canceled it to hold a prayer and intimate discussion with area residents. Mass shootings across the U.S. have long brought calls for stricter gun laws from gun safety advocates, and Thursday's did within hours. But the idea has been a non-starter for many Republicans, particularly in rural, GOP-leaning states like Iowa. As of July 2021, Iowa does not require a permit to purchase a handgun or carry a firearm in public, though it mandates a background check for a person buying a handgun without a permit. Ramaswamy said the shooting is a sign of a so-called psychological sickness in the country. In Des Moines, GOP rival and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said that gun violence, quote, is more of a local and state issue, end quote, in an interview with the Des Moines Register and NBC News. The high school in Perry is part of the 1,785-student Perry Community School District. The town is more diverse than Iowa as a whole, with census figures showing that 31% of the residents are Hispanic, compared to less than 7% for the state. Those figures also show that nearly 19% of the town's residents were born outside the United States. Quote, I'm not okay, end quote. Authorities said an active shooter was reported at 7:37 a.m. Thursday, and officers arrived within minutes. Emergency vehicles surrounded the middle and high school. Quote, officers attempted immediately to locate the source of the threat and quickly found what appeared to be the shooter with a self-inflicted gunshot wound, Mortvet said. Xander Shelley, aged 15, was in a hallway when he heard gunshots and ran into a classroom, according to his father, Kevin Shelley. Xander was grazed twice and hid in the classroom before texting his dad at 7:36 a.m. Kevin Shelley, who drives a garbage truck, told his boss he had to run. Quote, it was the most scared I've been in my entire life, he said. He later posted a photo on Facebook of his son being treated at the Methodist Medical Center and said the boy was feeling fine. He added, quote, I'm still shaking, and though I don't show it, I'm not okay, end quote. Rachel Karras, an 18-year-old senior, was wrapping up band practice when she and her bandmates heard what she described as 4 gunshots spaced apart. Quote, we all just jumped, Karras said. My band teacher looked at us and yelled, run, so we ran, end quote. Karras and others from the school ran out past the football field as she heard people yelling, get out, get out. She said she heard additional shots as she ran, but didn't know how many. She was more concerned about getting home to her 3-year-old son. Quote, at that moment, I didn't care about anything except getting out, she said. In a related article, Marissa Payne of the Gazette writes a column with the title, quoting Representative Ashley Hinson, can't legislate away this kind of hate in school shooting. Pressed on how she would address so-called sensible gun laws in the wake of a Thursday morning shooting at Perry High School, U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson told town hall attendees that, quote, anyone who even threatens this kind of violence has true hate in their heart, end quote, but that she wants to balance accountability with the Second Amendment. Quote, school shootings are absolutely terrible, said Hinson, who noted that she had yet to be briefed on the shooting that was reported at 7:37 a.m. at the Dallas County High School. The town hall, which drew about 30 attendees, started at 9 a.m. at Kirkwood Community College. The Marion Republican representing Iowa's 2nd District said the focus is on making sure law enforcement has the tools it needs to respond to and prevent such incidents. Quote, these are horrific tragedies, and anyone who decides to go to school, a grocery, any public event with this kind of hate in their hearts is an absolute monster, and I think if we could legislate away this kind of hate, we would have done it by now, Hinson said. Quote, I think there is a balance to be had here between protecting our Second Amendment rights in this country, which I've been a firm supporter of, and making sure that we can actually hold the bad guys accountable, end quote. An attendee at the town hall from Hiawatha, who did not give her full name, pressed Hinson on the shooting, where authorities said a 17-year-old killed a 6th grader and wounded 5 others. In Congress, Hinson has supported the Secure Every School and Protect Our Nation's Children Act to fund school resource officers and mental health counselors, strengthen school security, and establish a way for the federal government, schools, and law enforcement to better communicate. This would require federal agencies to provide training materials on a number of items, including mental health, to schools. But she has opposed measures such as the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which became law in 2022, that enhanced background checks for gun buyers under 21 and allocated funds for mental health and school safety programs. In the hour-long town hall, Hinson touched on topics including how to improve childcare access, crack down on undocumented immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, and reduce so-called wasteful government spending. Cedar Rapids Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell delivered introductory remarks. Inflation. Mike Mollers of Cedar Rapids said he's getting less money through Social Security and that property taxes on his condo went up this year while the federal government is, quote, spending money like it's water, end quote. Quote, the federal government is not doing its job to take care of people, he said. Hinson, a member of the House Appropriations Committee, said she supported a short-term continuing resolution to prevent a government shutdown, but she thinks it's important the government stick to the proper process to pass spending packages. Quote, it's time for Washington to start budgeting more like Iowa families have to, she said. Ann Solomon of Cedar Rapids said she filed taxes for a small business partnership she operates with her sister, and it took IRS officials so long to open the return that they considered it late. With insufficient IRS workers, Solomon said she didn't understand why Hinson didn't support the Inflation Reduction Act, which included funding, quote, to hire more tax agents, to improve the technology, and to go after the top 1% of people who they're getting away with a lot more than just me and my small business, end quote. While everybody should pay the taxes they owe, Hinson said, she didn't want, quote, an army of IRS agents going after hardworking Americans, end quote. Immigration. After U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials processed more than 300,000 migrants at the southern border in December, Hinson said, she joined GOP calls for Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to resign or be impeached. Hinson lamented, quote, overrun sanctuary cities, end quote, seeking a bailout from Congress, referencing a letter from the mayors of Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Denver, and Houston asking for $5 billion in assistance. Quote, I understand many are coming here to try and seek a better life. We have the most freedoms of any country in the world, and I understand why we want to come here, Hinson said, but there needs to be more legal pathways. Child care issues. Cedar Rapids School Board President Cindy Garluck asked for funding to supplement state support for the district's Truman Early Learning Center, a four-day preschool for four-year-olds. She said this improves outcomes for children. Garluck also asked that the 1975 Individuals with Disabilities Education Act's promise of 40% funding be fulfilled, while many districts in the state run so-called huge deficits with special education programs. The law requires states to give a free, appropriate public education to children with disabilities ages 3 through 21. Iowa law covers this from birth through age 21. Hinson touted her 2023 After Hours Child Care Act, which would expand child care and development block grant eligibility to families who work outside 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., incentivizing providers to offer early morning or late night child care hours. She also touted being part of a bipartisan group of lawmakers who supported the Maternal and Child Health Stillbirth Prevention Act, which passed out of the Senate in October and includes research and activities to prevent stillbirths. Returning to the front page of today's Gazette, Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau writes, Iowa physicians say proposed abortion rules are vague and restrictive. Proposed rules meant to provide guidance to physicians for performing abortions under a new law that remains tied up in court are too vague and restrictive and would hinder efforts to recruit and retain physicians, doctors, and opponents argued Thursday to the Board of Medicine. The warnings came during a public hearing in advance of the board meeting January 12th to review feedback and further consider rules for the implementation of the law that would ban most abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Lawmakers last year passed and Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law House File 732, which remains tied up in court during a rare special session of the legislature. It would change the amount of time women have to seek an abortion from 20 weeks post-fertilization to as little as 6 weeks before many women even know they're pregnant. The legislation prohibits abortions after cardiac activity is detected in an embryo. The law quickly was stayed by a Polk County District Court judge who granted a request from Iowa abortion providers to halt enforcement of the new restrictions until the law's constitutionality can be considered by the courts, while allowing the process that will draft rules for the law's implementation to continue. The proposed rules include specific guidance on how medical providers are to implement exceptions for rape, incest, fatal fetal abnormalities, and medical emergencies contained in the new law. While the ban contains some exceptions for abortions, some Iowa physicians have warned the restrictions do not account for complications that occur during pregnancy and would hinder their ability to provide care and respond to time-sensitive issues. Quote, "There is no set of rules that ever adequately address the spectrum of pregnancy emergencies or private reproductive health decisions we are entitled to make for ourselves," Leah Vandenbosch of Des Moines said during the hearing. Vandenbosch said she struggled with severe depression and eating disorders and chose to receive a, quote, "safe and legal," end quote, abortion due to medical concerns pregnancy would cause. Republican lawmakers and supporters of the law say the exceptions allow medical providers to exercise judgment and provide abortions when they believe one applies. Opponents contend the uncertainty and worry among physicians of potentially losing their medical license could prompt providers to put off abortions if they're uncertain. Under the proposed rules, to determine whether patients qualify for the exceptions for rape and incest, physicians would be required to gather details from women to determine when a sex act occurred, including if and when the act was first reported to law enforcement, a public or private health agency, or a family physician. Doctors would be required to document the information in the patient's medical records and make a so-called good faith assessment that the woman is being truthful and may require them to attest the information, quote, "was true and accurate to the best of her understanding," end quote. Dr. Emily Bovers, an obstetrician-gynecologist in Waverly, said the rules mandate medically trained professionals to try to interpret legal concepts. Dr. Rebecca Shaw, an OBGYN and associate professor at Des Moines University, speaking on behalf of the state's sexual assault response teams, encouraged the board to consider input from sexual assault nurse examiners before implementing the rules. As for determining whether a fetus has an abnormality, quote, "that in the physician's reasonable medical judgment is incompatible with life," end quote, doctors would be required to document diagnostic tests and procedures performed and their results, along with a description as to why they support the diagnosis. Sue Huppert, Chief External and Government Affairs Officer at Des Moines University, said she worries the rules would prevent the full scope of medical training necessary to practice in Iowa. The University of Iowa houses the only obstetrics and gynecology residency program in the state. However, Huppert said there has been interest from other healthcare organizations to create another residency program in the state. She urged the board to consider national accreditation requirements that are needed for the programs. Iowa has among the fewest OBGYN specialists per capita of any state, according to data from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. One-third of Iowa counties are considered so-called maternity care deserts, without a hospital or birth center offering obstetric care and without any obstetric providers, according to a 2022 report by the March of Dimes, a nonprofit focused on maternal and infant health. The lack of providers, particularly in rural areas, forces expecting women to frequently take off work and drive long distances for appointments. Quote, "Obstetrician gynecologists are already rare in Iowa," Bovers said. "I do anticipate that adopting rules like these will make that situation even harder," end quote. Bovers said she is the only OBGYN at the hospital where she practices and has been unable to recruit another to replace two who retired. Quote, treating our patients as people who need to be interrogated about their traumas and treating providers as extensions of government needed to gather these details and document them in what should be records that reflect medical care is going to jeopardize our ability to form a bond with our patients and provide them good care, she said. And it's also going to jeopardize our ability to recruit and retain providers in the state, end quote. Stephen Wall, a physician and member of the board at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, urged the board to provide better clarity to, quote, help avoid some of the risks that our providers face under these uncertain type of parameters, end quote. Quote, this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is a healthcare issue, Wall said. Physicians are very risk averse. They have their patients' interest in mind. And when they're faced with this dilemma of not knowing whether they're going to be adversely affected in their careers, making clinical decisions is not the appropriate direction they need to be faced with. End quote. Let's turn now to the Insight page in today's Gazette. Community letters include one from Mark Zeiger of Iowa City, titled, Critical Question for Trump at Upcoming TV Town Hall. At Wednesday's town hall on Fox News, someone must ask former President Donald Trump this. Did you knowingly authorize your lawyers to formally state in the main case to keep you on the ballot that you had, quote, never taken a so-called oath to support the Constitution, end quote, and will you now solemnly swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America? Signed, Mark Zeiger of Iowa City. Melody Turner of Cedar Rapids writes, Improve City Bike Code and Know the Rules. As I was driving along Otis Road several weeks ago, I almost hit a guy on a bike who had no lights or reflectors on his bike. He pulled out onto Otis Road off Blakely Boulevard right in front of me at about 5:15 p.m., and as we all know, it is already dark around that time. By the grace of God that I saw him in time to put on my brakes. This is not the first time this has happened. I realize people need transportation, but people should also realize that city code mandates a, quote, lamp on the rear visible from a distance of at least 300 feet, end quote, in Cedar Rapids. Reflectors aren't, but should also be mandatory on bikes. I would feel awful for this to have had a worse outcome. Signed, Melody Turner of Cedar Rapids. The Gazette's editorial today is titled, Feeding Kids or Playing Politics. Iowa has turned down $29 million in federal aid to provide food assistance to roughly 240,000 kids during the summer months. We believe the decision was a mistake. In a statement, Governor Kim Reynolds said the spending isn't, quote, sustainable, end quote, although it would take congressional action to scrap the program. She contends providing kids with $40 monthly through EBT cards won't promote nutrition and address an epidemic of child obesity. The state also would spend $2.2 million to administer the program. The cards, like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, don't restrict the purchase of pop, other sugary drinks and juices, and so-called junk food. What Reynolds is basically saying is low-income families can't be trusted to spend the money on healthy food, so denying a household with three kids $120 in extra food help monthly is for kids' own good. Reynolds would rather enhance existing programs, although we aren't sure how. This scapegoating of low-income families is cruel, but hardly surprising. This is a governor who pushed for new limits on SNAP participation and unemployment help by arguing that safety net programs had become a so-called hammock for recipients. The governor has repeatedly turned down millions in federal dollars related to climate change, affordable housing, child care shortages, and COVID testing in schools. In every case, Reynolds' excuses and reasoning don't hold water. 5% of dollars received by SNAP recipients are spent on pop, making it the number one purchase, according to a USDA report released in 2017. But they also spent 40% of assistance on so-called basic items, milk, eggs, bread, fruits, vegetables, and meat. Another 40% per dollar was spent on, quote, cereal, prepared foods, dairy products, rice, and beans, end quote. Studies have found that food insecurity makes obesity issues worse, not better. Families lacking access to a grocery store in food deserts and resources to afford healthier food, which can be more expensive, have more limited and often unhealthy food choices. If childhood obesity is truly an epidemic in Iowa, what is the governor's plan? Will she be outlining new initiatives for lawmakers to consider during the upcoming session? How much more money will she be directing to existing programs? Does the governor have a solution? Or did she simply use the obesity issue as an excuse to turn down federal money and criticize a Democratic president? The proof will be in the governor's policies, and Iowans will be watching. And that's the Gazette's editorial for today, Friday, January 5th. Today's Insight page also includes a guest column by Pam Yoakum, who is an Iowa State Senator representing Dubuque, and she is the Democratic leader in the Senate. Her guest column is titled, Senate Democrats Have a Better Deal for Iowans in 2024. As a state legislator, you must always remember who you work for. For me, it's the folks I see up and down Jackson Street at home in Dubuque. Out my front door, I see my neighbors catching the bus for work in the morning and coming home bone-tired in the evening. When I'm out gardening or taking a walk, they stop and tell me how they're doing. They tell me how $13 an hour sure doesn't go very far anymore, how hard it is to find childcare for their children, how they're concerned about Iowa schools and worried about losing their health care. That's what I hear in my neighborhood, and it's what Senate Democrats are hearing all across Iowa as we head into the 2024 legislative session. As the Senate Democratic leader, I've put 16,000 miles on my Chevy over the last few months, attending events from Belisca to Lamont to Fort Madison and beyond to meet Iowans and hear their concerns. Whether it's on a sidewalk in Dubuque, at a union hall in Keokuk, or in the library in Osage, Iowans are all saying the same thing. They're fed up with culture wars and special interest giveaways. They're tired of petty politics that divide us and deny our rights. And they're worried about the future, for themselves and their children. Iowans want a better deal from their state government, and that's exactly what Senate Democrats are fighting for in 2024. As the new session opens Monday, Senate Democrats pledge to lead with our shared values and advance an agenda that lifts all of us up together. And we're challenging the governor and our colleagues across the aisle to join us in that effort. Senate Democrats are committed to expanding and ensuring opportunity for every family, every child, and every worker in Iowa. Every family in every community deserves a fair shot at success, comfort, and an opportunity to get ahead. Every child should have access to a high-quality public education that prepares them for the life they want. And every worker deserves a chance to earn a paycheck that supports their family and respects their work. Costs are too high, especially for essentials like housing and childcare, and Iowans are hungry for solutions. Senate Democrats also will stand strong for the freedom of all Iowans to make their own choices and live their own lives without interference from the government. Our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain. Iowans believe in our state motto. We know a strong majority of Iowans support safe, legal access to reproductive health, including abortion. Extreme bans like the one the Republican majority forced into law last year attack fundamental freedoms and endanger the health of Iowans. Senate Democrats are also committed to accountability for politicians, government, and big business. Our state government belongs to the people, and it should work for middle-class and working Iowans, not self-serving politicians, influential interest groups, and out-of-state corporations. Senate Democrats will enforce checks and balances and resist efforts to silence the voices of average Iowans. Opportunity, freedom, and accountability. I'm hopeful that Republicans will join us on this agenda and that together we can govern in the best interest of every single Iowan. Iowans want a better deal, and in 2024, Democrats are committed to delivering. Again, this is a guest opinion from Iowa State Senator Pam Yoakum, a Democrat from Dubuque, who is the Democratic leader in the Senate. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, January 5th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Loretta Svoboda of Kelowna, aged 85, of Pleasant View Home in Kelowna, and formerly of Lucerne, passed away peacefully on January 4th. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, January 9th, at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Loretta grew up in Cedar Rapids and graduated from Jefferson High School. A memorial fund will be established in Loretta's memory. Online condolences may be directed to the family at www.cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Josephine June Marshall, aged 100, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday, January 3rd, at Heritage Specialty Care in Cedar Rapids. Private family services will be held at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. Josephine was born July 5th, 1923, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Gilbert and Victoria Goss. On October 14th, 1941, she married Albin Stillman Marshall in Cedar Rapids. Please share a memory of Josephine at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. David R. Price, aged 70, of Greenville, Ohio, passed away on Monday, January 1st, at his residence. David was born in 1953 in Cedar Rapids to Benita M. Holdren Price of Cedar Rapids and the late William J. Price. David served in the U.S. Navy and was a truck driver at Dick Levy Trucking in Bradford. The family will receive friends on January 7th at the Zekar Bailey Funeral Home in Greenville, Ohio. Memories and expression of sympathy may be shared at zekarbailey.com for the Price family. Richard Francis Hermanson, formerly of Cedar Rapids, more recently of Winnsboro, Texas, passed away December 29th in Texas after a long-term health issue. Rick was born April 7th, 1957, to Hubert Richard and Mary Jewel Hermanson in Waukon, Iowa. The family will provide and hold a private memorial at a later date. Kara Deanna Kors of Atkins was born July 21st, 1978, to Gloria Kors and Donald Williard, and raised by Gloria and Dwayne Janey. Kara was always adventurous, creative, protective, and loving. She loved her job as a CMA at Sterling Care in Coralville. On December 29th, the Lord, with no notice, called her home. She is loved by many and will certainly be missed by many more as her family grows. Visitation is Friday, January 5th, from 4 to 7 p.m. Funeral Mass is Saturday, January 6th at 10 a.m. at St. John the 23rd on Roncalli Drive Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Thank you to the Church and Father Richmond for everything you've done and are doing for our family. Brian Henry Ulrichs, age 55, of Monticello, passed away in the company of his family at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics on Friday, December 23rd. Visitation was held from 4 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, January 3rd, at Saints Peter and Paul Lutheran Church in Monticello. Funeral services were held on 11 a.m. on Thursday, January 4th, at Saints Peter and Paul Lutheran Church in Monticello. Brian was born in Langworthy, Iowa, to Donald and Kathy Ludwig Ulrichs on November 16, 1968. He graduated from Monticello High School in 1986. He married Roberta in 1994 and worked a variety of jobs throughout his life, most notably at the Anamosa State Penitentiary for 31 years. Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello is assisting the family, and information is available at kramerfuneral.com. Cindy Peterson, aged 66, of Alburnett, passed away on January 3rd. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. on Monday, January 8th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 a.m. on Monday, January 8th, at the funeral home. Luncheon will follow at the Chosen Few MC Clubhouse, 1027 9th Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Those unable to attend are invited to watch the service via live stream. The live stream link can be found on Cindy's tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Cindy was born in 1957 in Cedar Rapids and married Richard Schmidt in 2012. She was active in the Chosen Few and volunteered for many events. Dennis R. Mackey of Iowa City died on January 2nd at UIHC after a brief illness. Dennis was born in 1948 to Ray and Shirley Mackey of Toledo, Ohio, and he attended schools in Calumet, Michigan. He received a bachelor's degree from Michigan State, was awarded the Phi Beta Kappa Key. He then began a career in the building trades to the consternation and amazement of his friends and family. He later earned a master's degree in rehab counseling and a PhD from the University of Wisconsin. He began his academic career as an assistant professor at the University of Iowa in August 1982 and became associate professor in 1984 and full professor in 1995. Dennis also served as chair of the Department of Rehabilitation and Counseling at the university. In his 40 years as an academic, Dennis's focus was on raising the professionalization of rehabilitation counseling by focusing on clinical supervision, assessment, and cross-cultural issues relating to disability and rehabilitation. He was past president of the Council on Rehabilitation and of the American Rehabilitation Counseling Association, as well as a CRCC commissioner. He retired from the college in 2013. There will be a celebration of life, a party actually, on May 4th, 2024, Derby Day. The time and location are under consideration. And in obituaries of national interest, Glynis Johns, Mary Poppins star, has died at age 100. Glynis Johns, a Tony Award-winning stage and screen star who played the mother opposite Julie Andrews in the classic movie Mary Poppins and introduced the world to the bittersweet standard to be Send in the Clowns by Stephen Sondheim, has died. She was 100. Mitch Clem, her manager, said she died Thursday at an assisted living home in Los Angeles of natural causes. Quote, "Today's a sad day for Hollywood," Clem said. "She is the last of the old Hollywood." End quote. John's greatest triumph was playing Desiree Armfeldt in A Little Night Music, for which she won a Tony in 1973. Sondheim wrote the show's hit song, Send in the Clowns, to suit her distinctive husky voice, but she lost the part in the 1977 film version to Elizabeth Taylor. Quote, "I've had other songs written for me, but nothing like that," John's told the AP in 1990. "It's the greatest gift I've ever been given in the theater." End quote. Johns was the fourth generation of an English theatrical family. She was a dancer at 12 and an actor at 14 in London's West End. Her breakthrough role was the amorous mermaid in the title in the 1948 hit comedy Miranda. Other highlights include playing the mother in Mary Poppins, the movie that introduced Julie Andrews and where she sang the rousing tune Sister Suffragette. She also starred in the 1989 Broadway revival of The Circuit, W. Somerset Maugham's romantic comedy about love, marriage, and fidelity, opposite Rex Harrison and Stuart Granger. That concludes the obituary. Let's turn now to the sports section of today's Gazette. The lead article is written by Jeff Linder of the Gazette and focuses on Iowa women's basketball. It's titled, "The Hawkeyes Glue." Jill Martin pondered a question last weekend in the underbelly of Carver Hawkeye Arena. The subject was her daughter. As Jill's answer came to her lips, a primal scream echoed from the Carville tunnel 50 feet away. That was her daughter, too. Quote, "That's Kate," Jill said, nodding. "She's so loud." End quote. That's Kate, so loud, so beloved. Undisputedly and deservedly, Caitlin Clark is the face of the University of Iowa women's basketball program, which has risen to unprecedented heights. But Kate Martin is the heartbeat, the hard-nosed, soft-hearted captain, and yes, the glue, a term originally coined maybe by a media member or perhaps the Iowa Athletics social media team. Either way, it has stuck. Quote, "The glue thing, I think it's funny," Martin said last week. "I don't feel like the glue, but I try to live up to that name," end quote. In terms of eligibility, Martin is in her sixth and final year with the program. Her Hawkeye roots go back, way back. Her mother is the younger sister of Julie Fitzpatrick, who is the spouse of assistant, Iowa assistant, Jan Jensen. Quote, "Julie always said that Kate was our firstborn," Jensen said. "Growing up, Kate would come and stay with us from time to time. She was that little backwards hat-wearing athlete," end quote. Kate, age 23, is the youngest of three children born to Jill and Matt Martin. Kennedy is 28, and Trevor is 25. Quote, "My mom said it's our job to love the kids and the siblings' job to toughen them up," said Matt, who served as football coach at Edwardsville, Illinois High School, Kate's alma mater, before he and Jill moved recently to Moline, Illinois. Quote, "Kate is very unique. Our neighbors would attest to that. She had an electric motorcycle. She would wear a bandana and ride that thing. She'd go over to the neighbor's house and ask to shoot pool," end quote. One afternoon in 2003, a weary Matt came home from work. Quote, "I was kind of in a trance," he said. "I heard out the window, 'Hi, Dad.'" That was Kate, her first day riding a bicycle without training wheels at age 3. As Kate mastered her balance on the two-wheeler, Jill watched from the window of the house. Quote, "She just hopped on and went," Jill said. "She fell once or twice. Pretty soon she was flying down the street," end quote. Sports came naturally to Martin. She was a quarterback and linebacker on the tackle football team in elementary school. Quote, "I loved the contact on defense," she said. Basketball and volleyball came later. Quote, "You could tell by junior high that she had a shot to play at the major college level," Jensen said. "On her AAU team, she looked pretty good. I made sure that the rest of the staff was seeing her too, objectively, because of course I loved her. She was a hard-nosed utility player," end quote. Road to Iowa. Martin came to Lisa Bluter's summer camps nearly every summer, bunking at the home of Jensen and Fitzpatrick, of course, and it was common knowledge throughout the family that if Iowa offered a scholarship, Martin most likely would accept. Quote, "Dad would be honest with other coaches, telling them that if Iowa offered, it was going to be a tough race," Martin said. That offer came in the spring of Martin's junior year at Edwardsville. Martin committed a few months later. Her first year on the court at Iowa should have coincided with Megan Gustafson's final season, the Iowa Hawkeyes' elite 8-year of 2018-19. Instead, she tore her ACL at an All-Star game practice 3 days before her first practice in Iowa City and was forced to redshirt. Quote, "I got a steal and made a step-through move, got hit a little and I felt my knee go out," she said. "I was so scared," end quote. In retrospect, Martin said, "It was one of the best things that could happen. An injury can humble a person pretty quick. It taught me how to be a good teammate. I learned the offense, learned the system, and got stronger," end quote. The seeds of leadership were being planted. Still slowed by her knee, Martin played in 24 games as a redshirt freshman in 2019 and 20. So it came as a surprise to the outside world at Media Day in 2020 as a redshirt sophomore that she was elected co-captain. Quote, "The coaches, the team, they saw that leadership in her early," Jensen said. "She has their respect. It's been cool to watch it unfold. Like I tell my kids, hard work doesn't guarantee anything, but it does give you a better opportunity. She kept at it. Her role kept getting bigger and better," end quote. The 2023 National Player of the Year, Clark has been the program's superstar since the day she arrived on campus. But she understands and doesn't understate Martin's value. Quote, "She's one of those people you can lean on," Clark said. "She does a lot of dirty work, a lot of stuff that doesn't show up on the stat sheet or in a news article. We're wired the same. We go at each other in practice, all in good fun. Maybe gets a little serious sometimes. She's one of those people. We'll step off the floor and we're going to hug and be best friends," end quote. For her sophomore and junior seasons, Martin was good for 7 points and 4 rebounds per game. Her shooting percentage climbed steadily. Because of the NCAA's 2020 COVID-based waiver, 4 Iowa seniors, Martin, Gabby Marshall, Molly Davis, and McKenna Warnock, were eligible for a return for a 5th, and in Martin's case, 6th season. With the exception of Warnock, all elected for one more go-round. Quote, "I decided I didn't want to be done," Martin said. It's the pinnacle of women's basketball right now, and I thought I would push off adulting, get my master's degree, and go one more year. End quote. Next level. On the heels of last year's NCAA runner-up finish, the deepest run in Iowa history, this season's squad is 14-1, 3-0 in the Big Ten, and ranked number 4 in the nation, heading into tonight's game at Rutgers. Martin's offensive numbers, 11.7 points and 5.5 rebounds per game, 54.1% from the field, 87.9% from the free throw line, are all career highs. Those uncommon intangibles, those haven't suffered either. Quote, every challenge she has met it, and it changes game by game, Jensen said. She's going to be a dog, and she's going to defend the best player. If she leaves practice for a minute or two to go to the bathroom, you can tell the mood changes. It gets so much more quiet. She cares so much, sometimes we have to monitor her fatigue level. End quote. Jensen shared a story of Martin's earlier days with the program. Quote, there was a hawk alert, maybe a suspicious package downtown, Jensen said, recalling the story. It was at 1:15 a.m., and she was on her phone checking in with everybody. Everybody good? That is the next level, but it's just something she does instinctively. End quote. In the future. Martin is a WNBA long shot, though what team at any level can't use a little more glue? But there will be opportunities to play overseas, if she wants. Those around her consider a home run hire as a coach. Quote, she'll be a natural, her father said. This is a biased statement, but she's a culture builder, a program changer. End quote. Quote, she'll be phenomenal, Jensen said. She's going to have a long, successful career as a coach. She could make that transition tomorrow. End quote. Tomorrow, that's down the road. Today, she's having too much fun. Making noise, making connections, making memories. Quote, I'm so grateful the memories and friends I've made here, Martin said. I'm going to look back someday that these were the best times of my life. End quote. Televised games today. In the NBA, the Knicks are playing at the 76ers at 6:30 on ESPN and ESPN2. Grizzlies play the Lakers at 9 p.m. on ESPN. The Hornets are at the Bulls at 9 p.m. That game will be joined in progress on NBCS Chicago. In hockey, the Blackhawks are playing at the Devils at 6 p.m. on NBCS Chicago. In women's basketball, Iowa is playing at Rutgers at 5 p.m. on the Big Ten Network. In men's basketball, Connecticut plays at Butler at 5:30 p.m. on FS1. Illinois at Purdue at 7:30 on FS1. Boise State at San Jose State at 9:30 p.m. on FS1. In men's wrestling, Oklahoma State is at North Carolina State at 6 p.m. on ESPNU. Cornell is at Ohio State at 7 p.m. on the Big Ten Network. And in pro golf, the Century Tournament of Champions is at 5 p.m. on the Golf Channel. On the radio, you can listen to women's basketball at 5 p.m. on KXIC 800. And there will be local talk shows, Todd Brommelkamp Show at 6:30 a.m. on KGYM, Gym Class at 3 p.m. on KGYM, Spencer on Sports at 4 p.m. on KGYM. In the lifestyle section of today's Gazette, Kylie Alger's Commit to Be Fit column is titled, Choose One Word to Guide You in 2024. It's that time of year, New Year's resolutions. Unfortunately, these often ambitious goals statistically fizzle within the first couple of weeks of January. However, John Gordon, co-author of One Word That Will Change Your Life, offers a compelling alternative to the traditional list of New Year's resolutions. His idea is simple, yet powerful. Choose one word to define and guide your entire year. Quote, no goals, no resolutions, just one word that helps you write and create a yearly chapter in your life story. It's powerful, end quote. Instead of making traditional New Year's resolutions, Gordon suggests selecting one word that holds personal meaning and then using that word to guide your daily decisions. By focusing on your intention and designated word, you have laid the foundation to help you choose behaviors that align with what's important to you. The stark reality is that 9 out of 10 people fail with resolutions, with half of them falling short by the end of January. In contrast, Gordon has found that one word sticks. Remembering, focusing, and acting on your single word infuses life with meaning and mission, providing passion and purpose throughout the entire year. Gordon's chosen word for 2024 is first. The word I landed on is peace, while my husband, dad, mom, brother, and friend have selected curiosity, encore, rhythm, lean in, and connection. Gordon offers a structured approach on ways to discover your word, emphasizing the importance of introspection and connection to yourself and your higher power. First, look in. Take a moment to unplug from external noise and ask three essential questions. What do I need? What's in my way? What needs to go? Then, look up. Discover your word with an open heart. This may involve a moment of prayer, seeking guidance, and asking God or your higher power what they desire to accomplish in you and through you. Then look out. Live your one word. Reinforce your commitment by finding creative ways to remind yourself of your chosen word and intention. Whether it's hanging it on the fridge or making it your screensaver, the key is to be creative in incorporating your word into your daily life. Once you decide on a word, share it with others. Sharing your word often ensures success. Encourage coworkers, friends, and family to do the same. One word creates clarity, power, passion, and can be used as a team-building tool for personal growth. When you hear another person's word, you will most likely think of them when you see, feel, or experience their selected word throughout the year. As we stand on the threshold of 2024, it's an opportune moment to reflect on the word or short phrase that will positively impact your ability to follow through with what's important to you. So if you're tired of resolving to change and instead want to focus on what you're yearning for, go ahead and choose a word that energizes your commitment to yourself. Take a moment, listen to your inner voice, and discover the word that will guide you toward a meaningful and fulfilling 2024. Again, this is Kylie Alger's column in today's Living section of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Let's close today with Dear Abby. Today's column is titled, Mother Has Second Thoughts on Decisions Made for Sons. Dear Abby, my husband and I moved near the ocean last year. I have two sons, 21 and 17. My older son moved across the country with some friends. The younger son, Cody, chose at the last minute to stay with his dad. Abby, it has been awful. Cody dropped out of high school and did not keep up with his homeschool work. He quit his jobs and he's on depression medication. This week, both boys moved where I am. My house is small, so I got them an apartment in my name. The landlord thinks I'm going to be living there. My question is, how often should I go there and clean, make dinner, and visit? I feel like I'll want to be there all the time, before work, after work, and on weekends. My husband thinks I should back off, but Cody is only 17 and going through a lot. Any suggestions? Signed, Mom of Boys in California. Dear Mom, your older son is an adult. Your younger one is on the verge of becoming one. It's time for both to learn the skills they need to take care of themselves. If your older son has a job, he should contribute to the rent. Your younger son will never get into college if he doesn't do the homework he's ignoring. Having a small home doesn't mean he couldn't live with you until he establishes a routine. Although it's tempting, please do not deprive them of this learning opportunity. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, January 5th, 2024. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.